Hello and welcome to the Vox Office. I'm James Sandy, and in this, the first of our regular roundtable discussions for Switch Radio, looking into how the arts and culture sector in the West Midlands is weathering the storm, we place our focus on theatre. Before the lockdown was imposed, the UK's creative industry sector was estimated to be worth £110 billion. Faced with venue closures, social distancing and shifting public attitudes, theatre stands perhaps in the crosshairs of the crisis. Whilst Arts Council England has launched a £160 million emergency package across the cultural sector, the journey to recovery relies perhaps on more than just cash flow. Joining me around the virtual table to help me get some facts and fresh perspectives are Andy Watson, Claire Morton, and Richard Hayhow. Before we start the debate, let's get some context on our guests. Andy Watson trained in Paris and became artistic director of Geese Theatre in 2003. Geese Theatre facilitates drama-based group work, staff training, and consultation for the probation service, prisons, youth offending teams, and other settings across the UK and wider world. Andy is currently the vice chair of the National Criminal Justice Arts Alliance and sits on the Women's Prison Estate Advisory Board. He was made an MBE in 2018 for services to the arts in the criminal justice system. Claire Morton is executive producer at Vamos Theatre and joined the company in 2018, having worked across a range of projects with both independent artists and international touring companies. Vamos is a leading physical theatre company who employ a powerful mix of strong visual design, original soundtrack, and full mask theatre. Vamos has worked with schools, NHS staff, care homes, teachers, social workers, and the deaf community to ensure accessible, humorous, and very human theatre. Richard Hayhow has been director and chief nuisance maker at Open Theatre since 1990. Open Theatre works in special schools and SEN units for those with special educational needs, using non-verbal physical theatre to explore young people's creativity. Through platforms such as its Talent Lab, it supports young artists with learning disabilities in their professional career development in the arts. Open Theatre aims to develop skills, confidence and capacity across the arts sector in the West Midlands. We'll be discussing a number of key themes and questions as we go, but let's start with a short situation report from each of our guests. And Andy, alphabetically, we're going to start with you.
Okay, thanks, James. Yeah. I guess our situation in terms of the sectors that we operate and work in is pretty challenging at the moment. The primary arenas that we're working in are prisons, custodial institutions, secure hospital settings, and as you can imagine, the lockdown that we are experiencing in our own world is intensified somewhat in a custodial prison setting, which means that the vast majority of our projects, performances and work has come to a pretty rapid halt. As of, I think, March the 20th was the last piece of delivery work that we were engaged in. And we've seen pretty much everything cancelled or postponed through until September. But realistically, I think we're looking at 2021 when some of the prisons that we work in are likely to be open for business again in terms of the sort of work that we're delivering. So that's pretty challenging. My team have all, apart from myself, we've taken advantage of the government's furlough scheme. So we're kind of waiting to find out what the next iteration of that will look like. So yeah, it's pretty challenging. That added to the fact that, unlike a lot of arts organisations, we're not able to move our work onto kind of digital platforms. I mean, we are able to, but prisons don't have the infrastructure to allow men or women to access those platforms. So it'd be a fairly pointless process for us, which makes the whole situation, as I said, challenging.
Okay, Andy, thank you. Claire, let's come to you next for a bit of a short update.
Thanks, James. Yeah, I think lockdown for us started probably a week earlier than the rest of the country, as soon as the Prime Minister advised people not to go to the theatre, which I think was around the 16th of March. We'd already sensed it was coming, but it came very quickly in the middle of our tour of our new production, Dead Good, to theatres across the UK. So we had a week and a half left of our 35-day tour across the country, and we'd been planning that tour for probably 18 to 24 months, including venues that we'd not toured to before. So we were straight away into a situation of everything being either cancelled or postponed. But of course, not all of our venues being in a position to be able to rebook or replan straight away as things are so unclear for them. And then outside of our work on theatre stages, we were in the midst of planning our tour to care homes with our production Sharing Joy, where we get to perform with and interact with older people, those living with dementia and other life-limiting conditions in a care setting. And again, months of fundraising and booking with local partners, all postponed, and replacement dates yet to be agreed, as we don't know what we'll be able to do and when we'll be able to get into those settings again. And then we were just starting an exciting project with regional foster families, with including training for foster carers and staff, focusing on our non-verbal communication training packages. And then our walkabout acts, we were ready to go to take our walkabout acts to things like Glastonbury Festival and to Guernsey to take part in the VE Day celebration. So immediate lockdown, and then a situation of trying to plan and respond to events as they were continuing to unfold really rapidly, putting our energy into new places, into new online resources, a series of short mass films, and changing really how we worked overnight with everybody at home, communication happening in a very, very different way that was very new for us. And then, like Andy, having to take the decision to furlough nearly everybody in the team and trying to keep things going into a point that we can really regroup and come back together.
Okay, Claire, thanks. Richard, let's come to you.
Hi. Claire, we were in the middle of a national tour of Hansel and Gretel. And like Claire, also, we stopped that week of the 16th of March. So, and we'd spent a long time planning that. And so that's been a great disappointment. There were five professional actors with learning disabilities in that, plus a whole range of others. So there's that aspect of that. But also, so much of our work isn't about creating product. It's about working with young people with learning disabilities. So in our, we work across Birmingham and Coventry in 20 specials all year round. And through that work, reach maybe 2,500 young people. And we have lost the ability in many ways to connect and communicate with those young people. And we're just beginning to think how we can reinvent the way of connecting. And that's principally through working with families now rather than working through schools. We run quite a few classes, sessions, workshops outside of school as well. And we're managing to communicate and start to do things online through Zoom. But online is a very strange concept for us. We're very much into, as you said at the beginning, non-verbal work, which is really difficult to translate online, which is so heavily talk-based, as to how we communicate with the young people we work with. And also, the young people we work with are already quite socially isolated, so this is a sort of double whammy for a lot of them in that sense. We are just kind of trying to explore as many ways as possible of reaching out to those young people and finding ways of connecting with them in this time. And then the other factor for us is that we've lost a major source of income through the school's work. We've lost other sources of income, and so we're on a very tight budget now. And we have also furloughed people, but we luckily we've been able to retain a core team that are tackling some of these things together. This is
Switch. I think common across each of those accounts, there are some real common themes. And I think one of the things that perhaps sticks out, probably the things we should look at first, is I suppose the notion of theatre. A lot of people, I think, look at theatre as in being a big building full of actors and sets and things, but each of you, I think, through your organisations do very different things, very sort of community orientated, community focused things. And I think naturally it has to be very flexible, and you can try and adapt as best you can to this situation. But there are some big risks that, you know, we can't go back to a normal because some of it can't be preserved because it's very fragile or developing. So Andy, let's come to you on that point. In terms of risks, what do you think is what's the thing that perhaps keeps you awake in the small hours?
Well, I mean, I think the thing that I keep thinking about is that, you know, I've spent 23 years working in prisons and with some with men and women who, yes, they committed offences, they've done things they shouldn't have done, and they're being punished for that, of course. But I just keep reflecting on the restrictions that we're experiencing, the lack of freedoms that we are currently experiencing. And the impact that's having specifically on those men and women in prison, because the lockdown for us at home is hard. I'm sure it's hard in various ways for people, but if you're in prison, the lockdown is even harder. I think being locked down in your cell for 3 hours a day is unimaginable for most people. So I think in terms of, my work is built around the idea of hope. It's built around the idea of possibility. It's built around notions of change. It's built around using theatre to encourage people to move on, find new ways of being with their lives. I guess that, to go back to your question, it keeps me awake just wondering how people are coping when they're locked in their cells for 23 hours. And to be fair, whilst we can start to see maybe glimmers of possibilities, of things easing, I don't think that is going to be the case in custodial institutions for quite some time. So that keeps me awake at night, which is not particularly, to do with my work. It's to do with the impact of this on the cohorts of people who we generally work with. And I think, like you mentioned, the three organisations that are part of this conversation, we have very specific and unique kind of audiences that we work with. It's necessarily always your usual theatre audiences. I think we all work in somewhere at the margins.
So there's an interesting concept there, isn't it, in terms of a lot of us, I think, on our day-to-day think of, I suppose, the sort of constraints or the restrictions on our freedoms. And that's really around sort of freedom of, to go out and just do regular things. And there is this idea, isn't there, that, if you're locked at home long enough, you become more and more creative and you do more and more things. But actually, the kind of, I guess one of the risks is it really sort of, does it hamper or does it perhaps contain people's sort of creativity? Richard, let's get your thoughts on that.
Stuck at home is not that creative. I was just thinking, listening to Andy talk, that our process is very collaborative. It's about creating a space in which everyone can contribute and feel able and feel connected and develop their own skills, and they're respected for who they are in that process. That's incredibly difficult to achieve at the moment. How we create a collaborative process for anything we do over this period is a real challenge for us. I personally find I'm not being creative much at all at the moment. My job has turned into much more of a just keeping things going sort of job and managing day to day rather than what my role really is, which is about thinking through where we're going as a company for the future. I suppose what keeps me awake is, what does the future look like? And how can we possibly begin to dream about what we might be doing in 2 or 3 years' time, when we don't know what that will look like? Related to that also is that the notion that, is this just a pause in what we were going to do and we'll just come back and carry on where we left off? Or is this a sort of reinvention process that we're going through, and that things will look very different for us as an organisation when things back to some extent, not as big an extent as with Andy's, the people that Andy works with, we anticipate that lockdown in that sense will last much longer for the young people we work with. And I was reading something Birmingham City Council put out about the use of the word trauma in terms of the impact on vulnerable people, and we are beginning to see that in some of the young people we work with, that this is beginning to have a traumatic effect on those young people because of the nature of who they are, and how we support people through that process is a real challenge for us. Somebody typed a quote in a chat, which was a guy called Augusta Boal wrote, which is, theatre can happen anywhere, even in theatres. And I find that quite inspirational at the moment, in terms of hanging on to some hope that whatever happens, we can carry on doing what we do.
Claire, I was going to pick up the point that you made earlier about, in a lot of ways, theatre was the kind of first part of the sector and first industry, I guess, to be locked down before lockdown even. And I think the greatest risk of that was that at that time, people didn't really perhaps understand the scale or the extent. And I think we're still trying to struggle with that. But I'm interested from your perspective in terms of the work that Vamos does. Obviously, there is a direct economic and a kind of workforce impact. But what about the sort of longer sort of social and educational things that Richard and Andy have touched on? Is that something that is in the planning at the moment, or is it really just trying to keep sort of Monday to Friday ticking over, and probably the weekends as well?
Honestly, it feels, whilst we've been in this period of lockdown and we've furloughed a lot of staff, like it's just the keeping going, the Monday to Friday and whatever it needs, as Richard said, the kind of the caretaking of things just to keep things going whilst we've been waiting to see how things unfold. I think very early on, we kind of went into rapid emergency mode and coming up with loads of ideas of what we could do and what we needed to do. And we literally started on it the next day. And then it became very clear very quickly that the situation was evolving quicker than we could keep pace with. And the scale of it, as you say, was developing and becoming clearer. And so actually, we just had to put the brakes on a bit to let the situation unfold. And I think in terms of things keeping us awake, there's definitely the impact on the people that we normally work with, vulnerable people, whether they're older people in care homes or people with learning disabilities, and even the actors and the freelancers that we work with on a daily basis. You know, the impact on individuals has been immediate. And then in a longer term, the thing that keeps me awake at night is how on earth we get back on our feet as a creative industries. Whilst we were one of the quickest to go into lockdown, we may be one of the slowest parts of the country to kind of come back out of it. We don't know what the new models are going to be. As Richard said, we don't know if we're coming back to, is it a pause in the normal way of doing, or is it a complete re-examination in how we work and the ways that we will be required to work in the future. I mean, if we just look at touring theatres in a kind of traditional sense, we're looking at a situation where some venues are saying they might only be able to have 30% of their seats on sale for any one performance. So straight away, what that does to the economy of touring, that is already very hard to make it balance, and then combining in with that what, you know, how audiences are going to feel about doing things like going to the theatre again or coming and taking part in a workshop is really tricky. And I agree that we've kind of lost that collaborative process and creativity. And then in other ways, as we've had to, under lockdown, kind of start to think of some other ways of doing things, it's strangely become quite a creative time, artistically, particularly for our artistic director, as we've been thinking up kind of new ways to engage, to try and keep our connection with people going through lockdown. So I suppose what we're trying to do is keep things going until they become until the situation's a bit clearer, and then to look at the landscape and think how do we bring these new ways of doing into the old, and which bits stay and which bits need to be revamped and which bits kind of get thrown out completely.
You're listening to The Vox Office with me, James Sandy, here on Switch Radio, a virtual roundtable discussion for the arts and culture sector in the West Midlands, and this time we're focusing on theatre. And joining me are three theatrical guests, as it were, Richard Hayhow, Claire Morton and Andy Watson. There are a couple of analogies I'll throw in, really kind of hopefully theatrical analogies. So there's a kind of an idea that everyone's running on a kind of skeleton crew, if you like, and that's the first one. But there's also, I think Richard touched on this, there's this idea that there's a kind of a phoenix will rise from this, okay? But it's really trying to get a sense of what will be left in those ashes, isn't it? And, you know, I don't want to sort of put too much doom and gloom on our situation, but it's the question I'm trying to get to is, I think there are lots of really good bits of, you know, resilience and good practice and business planning going on, but I'm wondering as a sector how collaborative the West Midlands is and can be, and, you know, in some ways in an industry that is naturally competitive, isn't it? You know, people are driving what they're doing forward. So I wonder what people's thoughts are, sort of beyond the kind of practical and mechanical, how the sector might be perhaps more cohesive going forward.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not necessarily sure that I would agree with the idea that the sector is competitive. I mean, there are elements of competition, it's usually around sources of funding, I think. And if there is a positive that's coming out of this, I think it's some of those conversations that cross kind of organisational size. I think those are being really positive, on an understanding that no one really has an answer, but maybe collectively we can come to some sort of understanding about what some of the answers might look like. So I feel quite positive about the idea of collaboration. That I know the Arts Council had just launched their newest 10-year strategy called Let's Create. They were identifying that participation in arts projects was going to be prioritised, that people who don't normally access the arts were going to be prioritised, that communities such as the ones that Richard and my organisation work with were going to be identified as priorities. I'm desperately hoping that that will remain the same over the next 10 years, because I think it's important to recognise that theatre is much more than the big institutions.
Claire, let's come to you next in terms of that, the health of that kind of dialogue, that kind of collaboration. How does it look from your perspective? Is it something that is strong and improving, or is it something that's been perhaps challenged in the current situation?
I think it's actually something that we're very good at as a sector, that we've always been very good at, and we've had to be good at, and we're generally very generous in kind of the ways that we share knowledge and skills. So whilst we might normally be collaborating on a more kind of artistic project, I think at the moment that collaboration is continuing behind the scenes. I think there's a real challenge for lots of organisations, as you said, with everybody kind of going to skeleton staffing, and the capacity to be able to have the time to have those conversations in a situation where lots of people are juggling, you know, more things than they've ever juggled in their life, all from home. Many people trying to homeschool their children as well, or having caring responsibilities. So I think there's that challenge in capacity for us to be able to do that. But I think there's a lot of collective brain power in the sector, and generally a lot of generosity. And I think we're well placed to problem solve some of the big things. We're used to working in difficult conditions. We're used to working with limited resources. And we're also used to generally being quite fleet of foot and having to respond and be flexible. So I think all those things place us really well to be able to respond as soon as we have a bit more of an idea about what we're kind of responding to and in what way, if that makes sense.
Okay, Richard, let's come to you, because I'm conscious you, of the three folks around this virtual table, you've probably been with your organisation the longest, I think since 1990. So you've obviously seen a lot of changes in the sector regionally in that time. How does it look at the moment? Is it still in good health in terms of its, you know, its culture, if you like, in terms of its relationships, or other things perhaps it needs?
I'm kind of agreeing with both what Andy and Claire said, is that we are quite a collaborative sector. In recent years, I suppose, what I've seen is more willingness to understand the differences between what we're all trying to achieve and work with those, rather than thinking we're all, just because we're connected with theatre, we're all doing the same thing. We've worked in partnership with many of the big organisations like Birmingham Hippodrome, the Rep, the Belgrade Theatre, Imagineer Productions and various others right across Birmingham and Coventry. And in that process, we're trying to understand what's different between us and how, by celebrating our differences, we can create something together that we couldn't do on our own. My worry, I suppose, is that in these times, everyone will want to come out of this playing safe, whereas what I'm talking about is that spirit of adventure and risk-taking that you need in order to be truly effective in collaboration, and that collaboration can't really be done by talking about it. It has to be done by doing things together. So that's what I'm really missing at the moment, is the ability to talk about what work we might do together in the future and then get on and do it. Because that is the essence of collaboration for me. Having said that, I like Andy, I've seen the Culture Central and all those groups of people that are coming together to really try and solve some problems together. And I've got a lot of respect for all of that at the moment, and try to be in as many of those discussions as possible so that we retain that sense of togetherness.
And we're going to move now to talk about, I suppose, some of the opportunities that the current situation presents. It's difficult, I think, in some ways to call it that, or to term it in that way, but it has meant, I think, certainly from our discussion so far, people have mentioned this, but it has meant that we've had to do things quite differently, and we've had to sort of diversify the way perhaps we approach things, and also perhaps the kind of list of people that we work with, or, you know, perhaps take on the work of. So, Richard, let's come to you first, because as you said, it's quite a challenge in terms of some of the very local and very home-based work that you that you do and your company does. How, what immediately had to change? I mean, in terms of what you sort of identified needed, you needed doing differently, because I imagine that, you know, it's very difficult to distance and to engage, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the core of the dilemma in that sense. So we have started doing a lot of Zooms with the young people that we work with out of school contexts. And as I said before, we're trying to engage more with families and enable them to do the work that we might have done with those young people in school, but to support parents to interact with their young people. So we've created some very short videos about some simple exercises or ways of engaging that we then share, and the parents hopefully watch those and then start to do the exercise with their young person who's living at home. With a lot of the Zooms, we're trying to work out, it's interesting, to begin with, the young people we work with are quite reticent about joining on Zoom, but once they got the hang of it, they then all started wanting to do things at the same time. So we had 15, 20 people, young people on a Zoom, all wanting to engage in doing something, and it's becoming quite chaotic. So we're now looking at splitting up into really small groups so that we can pursue particular ideas with particular young people. So we're kind of learning a little bit. But I think that one of the interesting things, because a lot of our young people don't want to come online and they don't want to connect with people in that way, and that may be to do with that instinctive sense that this isn't real connection, this is just a substitute sort of thing. And there's one young man in particular who will not come on a Zoom, and we've recorded the Zoom session with the group that he's normally in, send it to his dad, and his dad sits in a room watching the video of our Zoom and explaining to his son what's happening, and his son is in another room listening, and occasionally pops his head round and to say, oh, that was good. So we then started thinking, what we need to do actually is go out and to where this young person lives and say hello on their doorstep as a way of engaging. And then we started thinking, well, maybe we could get people to start acting things out on their doorways that we could go around and film and create some kind of film work with. And then we thought, oh, we might draw attention to ourselves by doing that in a street. People might come out and say, what are you doing? And then we thought, well, actually, that's an audience. So maybe we should celebrate the fact that we're doing these things on doorsteps and get the street to come out and watch us filming and watch the young people acting out whatever they're acting out. So we've now created this project called Digital Doorways, where we're trying to explore how we can do all of that and make it into that thing where Augusta Bauer says theatre can take place anywhere. So we could do it in the street. Socially distanced, obviously, at all times, but it's just looking at how do we carry on connecting through to our young people in creative ways, and that's the big challenge, is not how do we not only stay in touch with our young people, but how do we continue to enable them to become creative, how we develop their skills through this process, as opposed to just wait until another time when we can come back together. It is beginning to feel quite creative as a process now.
I'm getting a sense now of why Chief Nuisance Maker is in your title, I think. Claire, let's come to you, because Vamos, I think, have always done, I think, things online, and most theatres, in present company included, do a range of interactive digital platform things. But how have you had to adapt and change some of the things that Vamos does?
Yeah, we've been starting to kind of do more digital things over the last few years, particularly around creative learning. So that's something, as we went into lockdown, we kind of naturally geared up our digital learning resources, which we were in the process of doing. It just kind of we progressed it a bit more rapidly. So in terms of kind of being able to continue to engage, I like this idea of distance whilst engaging. It's a real contradiction. But yeah, in terms of trying to continue that engagement, we've released a lot of digital resources, including an online recording of our theatre production, Dead Good, for educational settings, a series of master technique films, and an education pack to go with the show. And we've had such a great response. I think everybody's felt quite thirsty, really, for ways to engage and for new content. So far we've had requests from teachers all over the world, including Uganda, Australia, and we've sold some of our mask sets to Australia and Israel. So in a way, it's been quite an exciting time as we've put our energy into to some of the more obvious things. And one of the first things we did when we went into lockdown and kind of into emergency response situation was we started to make some short films that were focused around the idea of social isolation. And we made 36 and released them via social media from, I think, the first day of lockdown. And we had such a great response to them, and lots of people saying that it was, the films had become the highlight of their day, it was making them less lonely, this kind of way to engage with something kind of beyond their immediate household. And this really excitedly now led to us being awarded a Culture in Quarantine commission from the BBC. So at the moment, our artistic director, Rachel Savage, is really busy with her head down, making 21 short films on the theme of isolation with some of our key collaborators that are at some time soon going to be on the TV, which is really exciting. And for us, kind of allows us to still engage with our audiences and hopefully get some new audiences and try to connect in a meaningful way with people directly into their homes and on the television, hopefully.
Andy, let's come to you because I'm conscious some of the things, or some of the settings, if you like, that you work in most frequently are, I mean, they are usually in lockdown, let's put it that way, in some sense. But there's more, I guess, there are perhaps more constraints in terms of how you can interact with them?
All our work is dependent upon gatekeepers, like literal and metaphorical gatekeepers, allowing us access to the people who generally participate in our work. And, you know, those gatekeepers have got very different priorities at the moment. So, you know, it's not possible to access the men and women that we would be working with in a custodial setting. And as I mentioned, like really early on, it's also not possible to move things onto kind of digital platforms because the infrastructure within prisons doesn't exist for that to be viable. So that makes that very, very difficult. I mean, I absolutely love hearing what Richard and Claire are managing to do. It's just, I think, both brilliant examples of, you know, the creativity and imagination and desire to still make work that is meaningful is wonderful. I wish I had another example to contribute, but we are very much in that the phase of still struggling to figure out how we can get in to the institutions. Either, you know, obviously we can't physically, so the question still remains for us. Well, so what can we do? One of the things that we're sort of toying with is that there is a national prison radio, which operates within all prison establishments. So one of the thoughts that we're currently having is to move some of our performance work into a kind of radio format. So that's something that's sort of in the back of my mind is a potential. And then the other part of our work is very much about training and engaging with people who are interested in developing kind of arts in criminal justice settings. So one of the things that I've been doing is hosting some, I'm calling them question and answer sessions, basically, where anybody who is interested in the work of Geese or in the broader sector of theatre and criminal justice is just able to join me on a Zoom call or a Google Meet call and just ask whatever question they might have about their work, their practice, and we can just sort of engage in conversations about that, which to my mind is really important. We can't let lose sight of how important some of this work is that we're all talking about, and it needs practitioners to be interested in it, and it needs people who are emerging into the world of theatre to still see it as a viable option. So it's important for us that we're still sort of maintaining some level of connection to people who might go on to be a part of this sector as well.
Let's just consider some of that actually in terms of the viability of where we are at the moment. One of the things that fascinates me is for a long time we've all used online platforms and online wizardry. It's never really, there are a number of big platforms. Spotify is probably the best example. It's never really broken even in terms of in terms of an income generator. Do you think that the kind of perhaps the attitude is changing in terms of what people are willing to pay for or subscribe to, or what do people think about that? Because obviously that's going to be a, I think, quite a key income strand, isn't it, going forward?
I think it's an interesting question and a necessary one, as we all kind of move to different ways of doing things. A lot of the content that I've seen, most of it has been free. And if this becomes a longer term thing, which realistically, it is going to change how we work for at least into the medium term. How do we start to make sense of that, and how do you quantify value for something in a digital format that people have maybe been used to getting for free? And I suppose the jury's out on that, really.
Richard, what's your thought on that?
I'm just trying to work that out, actually. It's a bit of a puzzle. I think most of our work, if I use this phrase, is free at the point of use, or whatever that phrase is about the National Health Service. That for our young people, we don't ever want them to have to pay in that sense for engaging with us or for being part of what happens, and even for as much as possible for product that we create. I think the other factor for us is that at the moment, and this is our challenge, I can't see online work ever replacing what our core values are and what we really want to do. Like Claire said, we're happy to share the stuff that we do because it's a way of staying connected, not because we're making money from it. At the moment, that may change. But even, I mean, we did we filmed Hansel and Gretel, luckily, and we're able to do an online version of it, and we got probably 8,000 people have watched that way. But I would struggle to think about, firstly, how we would make people pay for that, and secondly, how that would replace what we do, which is make theatre in that sense. And the live engagement of an audience with a production is the core of what we're about, and the filmed version just is an added bonus, if you like. So there's real questions for us about that, and how we could ever think about making money from online work.
You're listening to The Vox Office with me, James Sandy, here on Switch Radio, a virtual roundtable discussion for the arts and culture sector in the West Midlands, and this time we're focusing on theatre. I'm conscious our time is nearly up, and it's a good point, I think, to ask the question in terms of what you might need as organisations, but also what you think the sector needs more broadly. We've touched on some of those things. So what I'll do is I'll ask Richard, Clare and Andy just individually some of the kind of asks, if you like, some of the things that at the current point in time people listening could perhaps respond to and be able to help with. So Andy, let's come to you really. What's your ask in terms of the public? Let's start with the public.
Don't forget about this sector would be one ask. Don't believe that the stuff that you're accessing on digital platforms is the same as what you're getting when you go and see stuff live. I would always argue that it's a second option, but don't think just because NT Live are showing you these things on a Thursday evening and all the other great bits of theatre that you can now see on various digital platforms as discussed, don't believe that that is it. That's not what theatre is. That's just a sort of almost like a secondary version of what you might be missing. There's something about the community, there's something about a community of people watching something together in the same space together at the same time, observing each other, watching the performance. I just think that is what makes theatre utterly unique. What I really hope is that people don't lose sight of that. I don't think the public generally, whoever the public are, I don't think they will. So I guess that's one thing that I would be my request.
And Claire, let's bring you in on that. What's your reasonable demand from the audience, as it were?
Yeah, it's tricky. I think it's to echo what what Andy says. It's to support us, to remember us, and to support us in whatever way you can, so that we can hopefully get back to that point where we can engage in a really meaningful way again. Whether that's supporting your local arts centre or arts company with a donation or a gift voucher, and having the confidence to in time come back and to experience art in real live time in person. We're going to need the public's help more than ever to come out the other side of this. So, I'd say to stick with us and support us in whatever small way you can, so that important work for those that really need it can continue.
Richard?
Yeah, I think we're in a place of agreement about all this. I think the only thing I'd add in is some reflection on how we can value the creative stuff we're doing at the moment in terms of helping us get through this, and therefore how important the arts are in the lives of everyone, as opposed to let's just go and see a show, the sort of feel about what theatre's about, that actually the engagement of all of us in creativity is fundamental to who we are and what we want to do with our lives in all sorts of different ways. And I'm hoping that people will get a better recognition of that through what's happening now in that sense.
Well, that's it for this session. My thanks to Andy Watson, Claire Morton and Richard Hayhow. For more information and links on some of the topics and organisations we've discussed, you can visit our website www.switchradio.co.uk. The Vox Office was written and presented by me, James Sandy, facilitated and directed by Mandy Rose, and is a King of the Buttons and M7 PR co-production for Switch Radio.